There are many people who still believe, there might be some amongst you here, that argue that the Constitutional Revolution was essentially made by the British. Why? Because any attempt at freedom has been, over the last 150 years, made to be suspect, to be part of the colonial game. My point is that that is a misreading of our past. We need to research our past. And I think if we do this, if we begin to reread our tradition, and if we begin to reread it from a new perspective, and I'll try to explain what that perspective is, we will realize that, contrary to the claims that has now become gospel, Iran had an attempt at modernity long before modernity came to the West. Between the 9th and the 12th century, I have tried to make this argument at some length in the book called Tajaddud wa Tajaddud Sitizi Dar Iran, and I'm trying to make the same argument in another book that is coming out in English in a few weeks, I think. My argument is, and I'm not sure that I'm right, but I'm suggesting it, and I know some people in this audience would probably disagree with me. Professor Karimia Hakak might have some disagreement with some parts of it, some agreements with parts of it. Professor Afshar, the same thing. Professor Milani, the same thing. Professor Holakui, the same thing. But all of these people that I mentioned are precisely the category of people who I think are, for the first time in the history of Iran, capable of offering this new reading. We need to read the past from a new light, which is at once Iranian and global. In other words, we need someone who is not awed by Shakespeare or by Melville and is not ignorant of Hafez or Sa'di. Someone who is at home in both of these fields. Someone who knows recent theories of criticism, but can also read and write in Persian. Is comfortable with Shahnameh. Can read Shahnameh as well as Professor Hakak read Shahnameh for you. I kept hearing my friends complimenting him on his rendition of these poems. Someone who can do that, and at the same time argue from the latest theories of the West. This combination, this kind of a view that is Iranian and global, that is not too enamored of Iran, who doesn't think that all that is good is Iran, that there is nothing wrong in our past. No, there is plenty for which we have to be ashamed of. There is a whole history for which we have to apologize. We have to apologize to a lot of minorities. We have to apologize to women. We have to apologize to religious minorities for all that has been done to them and are being done to them. Yet, we have also a lot to be proud of. Someone who can say both of these things and also know both the advantages and the disadvantages of the West. That kind of a perspective that is available in the people that I mentioned and is increasingly made available amongst a category of intellectuals is going to allow us to reread our culture, and it's going to be a difficult process for reasons that I tried to explain, and come up with a new reading of our own past. If we do this, my hypothesis is that we will come to conclusion that there was a modernity in Iran before there was a modernity in the West. In fact, some of the ideas that we call modern went to the West from Iran. And I'll give you a couple of examples. There are many examples of ideas we think quintessentially Western, quintessentially rational, that were in fact far more developed in 11th century Iran than they were in 11th century Europe. In fact, Europe learned these things and I'll give you some examples, precisely as a result of the Crusades. With the Crusades, they came to the East. They expected to find a desolate land because they thought they were Christians, they were the children of God, and everyone else was an infidel. Instead, they found a very thriving culture. They found a culture that in many ways was far more superior to them. That's why they took, even in the Eastern Christianity, they found something that was far superior to the West. That's why they took half of Constantinople and rebuilt Venice with it. Half of the buildings, half is an exaggeration, but many of the most beautiful buildings in Venice have been literally uplifted from the East and brought to the West. That kind of a bringing back is far more extensive than what you find in Venice. Now, one of the main problems facing this new generation, and again, if you look back on the 3-4 generations of Iranian modernists of the past, they have usually have one of these two qualifications. The first generation, for example, the people who began experiencing the West wanted to completely estrange themselves from their own tradition. Leave behind tradition. Iran has nothing to offer for a modernist. That was the argument of the first generation. The second generation, some of the people in the second generation who began to publish some of the texts of our past, people like Fruzanfar, people like Qazvini, people like Henri Corbin, these people were laughed at by Iranian modernist intellectuals. Sadegh Hedayat wrote one of his most cruel short stories about Fruzanfar, for no other reason than Fruzanfar didn't know Kafka, probably. Of course, they say there was also a reason that they didn't let Hedayat come to the university, but the way he attacks Fruzanfar, calling Fruzanfar someone who does nothing but naqsh qabr, becomes a motto of a whole generation of Iranians who don't know their tradition and are willing to learn a French poem, learn Russian history, learn American history, much more than they would learn Persian history or Persian poem. Then you have a third category of people who knew the West all too well, or all too little, as the case may be, but had very little contact with Iran. They didn't want to do anything with Iran. We have people in Iran writing today, as we speak, write about modernity as if he is in Germany. There is nothing about Iran in this book. I read it and I can't believe that someone who is in Iran is so completely strange from his surrounding, from his context. The context is Iran. Now, this generation that I gave you some examples of, I think are going to be pioneers in rereading this past. Now, one problem is that much of our past is not available to us. Let me give you a couple of interesting, at least were interesting for me, anecdotal evidence for it. In 1959, the Shah goes to Vatican for a visit. There are two reasons given for why he went. And I tried to get the Vatican archives to open their files to me so I could find out what the real reason was. And I found out that the Vatican archives are much more difficult to get into than even the British archives. The British archives have a 35-year limit. The Vatican archives have a 75-year limit. Now, the theory is that the Shah went there to get annulment for his first marriage so that he could marry the daughter of Emmanuel. There was a princess the Shah was interested in, and that part is for sure. There is no doubt about that. And the Pope apparently says no, because he says the Shah has been married once before, and a good Catholic girl can't marry someone who's divorced. unless the divorce is annulled. Some say he went for that, some say he just went because he wanted to visit the Pope. I don't know which one is the truth. The Pope gives him a gift, or he gives him a couple of gifts. One of them, of course, is the Pope's own picture. The return, of course, in return, Shah gives him the standard Persian gift at the time, a Persian carpet. And the second gift that he gives, I was fascinated by, is a 3-volume bibliography of original Persian and Arabic and Turkish texts, unpublished manuscripts in the Vatican Library. There is a 3-volume bibliography of it. A few years later, I was talking to a friend of mine. His name is George Saliba. He is a professor at Columbia University, and his work is in medieval sciences. He calls it Arabic sciences. I call it Iranian Islamic sciences, because many of the people he writes about are actually Persians. They wrote in Arabic, so he calls them Arabs. Now, he told me, he asked me whether I knew someone in Qom. I said, why Qom? He says, in one of the schools, one of the Ayatollah's schools, there were 3 main libraries in Qom. This was the smaller one. He says, there are 5,000 manuscripts that are still not even annotated, not even chronicled. I want to find out whether there is someone who can tell me what these texts are. In other words, there is an abundance of texts that are about our past that are yet not published. Hafez, our greatest poet, had his first complete editions in 20th century. Sa'di, the same way. Bayhaqi, the same way. Many of these were originally published, found by Westerners. It is only the last 40 years that some people have begun to publish annotated, correct, scholarly editions of some of these books. Tariqh-e Bayhaqi, about which I will talk a little bit, is one of the greatest books in history. But of its 30 volumes, we only have 1/30th of it left. 29 volumes is gone. We don't know where it is. And the list goes on. So unless these books are published, are annotated, and are analyzed from a new perspective, from this kind of a global Iranian perspective, not from a perspective that already has assumed that Iran has nothing to contribute to the world, I think we will come away from this reading thinking that we have had a much, much greater role in shaping Western consciousness and in shaping modernity, in creating modernity than has hitherto been agreed to. Now, if you follow the path of the West, I gave you some examples about Herodotus. This is the beginning of Western consciousness. The next step, major step, in the development of Western consciousness is the emergence of a man named Saint Augustine. At the time, his name was Augustine. Later on, he was beatified. He was called Saint. I strongly urge you to read, if you get a chance, his Confessions. Confessions of Augustine is one of the great classics. It's one of those 50 books that we always think that every college student must read before they get out of college. It's one of the greatest, great books. And it's a very beautifully written book. It's a very good read. He talks about how he came to Christianity and how, because he was born into a family where his father was an absolute gambling infidel who made fun of Christians He was in 4th century, and he was born in where today is Algeria. His father was an absolute heretic. His mother was a very devout Christian who wanted his son to become a mullah. Her dream was for her son to become a priest. And for the first 18-20 years of his life, Augustine was a very reckless young man. He had many affairs. He lived with a woman with whom he was not married. He had a child with her. He gambled. He stole things, as he explains in his confession, the famous peach that he steals. And then he has a conversion and becomes Christian. There he talks about how ideas about Zoroastrianism, ideas from Mani, the tradition of Mani, ideas from the Mithraic religion had infiltrated all the way to Algeria. And he says that I became a Zoroastrian Manichaean before I gave it up and became a Christian again. Now, many people say that what he developed into Christianity, what became the Augustinian Catholic Christian ideology, is very much indebted, very, very much indebted to Persian traditions, to Iranian traditions of Zarathustra, to Iranian traditions of Mani, to Mithraic religions. Again, there is another book. If you think that I am Persian exaggerating about the virtues of Iran, I suggest you read a book by Bloom, Water Time. Mr. Holakui has a lot of criticism for him, but I am very grateful. It gives me a chance to. Many people think that the bulk of the Christian Catholic ideology, in fact, comes from this tradition. And one of the books that, again, I suggest, if you get a chance, read, is a book by Harold Bloom. It's called Omens of Millennium. He wrote this when everybody was worried about 2000, what the computers are going to crash and what's going to happen in the 2000-year cycle or the 1,000-year cycle. And he picked up all the themes that in that culture were Persian in origin. And he says this sort of hysteria is really the revival of Zoroastrianism. It's got nothing to do with Christianity. There he talks about all the ideas in Christianity that come from Persian traditions, from the idea of a millennium, to the idea of the devil, to the idea of angels, to the idea of a resurrection of the body. All of these, Bloom argues, come from that tradition. The next major moment in Western consciousness, I refer to the Renaissance a little bit, I don't want, because of a shortage of time, go back to it. The next important moment of consciousness in the West is, of course, 19th century. The West has now become the big bully on the block. And I gave you one version of how the West views Iran. That's the colonial version. But there is another side to Western consciousness of Iran in 19th century. This can be found, for example, in the writings of people like Emerson. Emerson is said to be the quintessent American intellectual. He is said to be the embodiment of American intellectual ideology. And when you read Emerson, he says, the book that impacted me, the book that is, in terms of its wisdom, is on par with the Bible, is Sa'di's Golestan. And he read Sa'di in translation. Read Melville, the great American novel, the writer of the great American novel, Moby Dick. You've all heard the name Moby Dick. If you haven't read the book, I'm sure you have all had a sandwich made by Moby Dick, or a churro kebab in the Washington made by Moby Dick. But before it was a sandwich shop, Moby Dick was a book. And it was a very interesting book about Captain Ahab, and you read it, and the liberating ideology in this book, the liberating passion of this book, is Persian, very clearly. And it is the Persian Zoroastrian ideology that is fighting this corrupt Western Christianity that Melville wants to overthrow, essentially. The whole movement of transcendental literature in 19th century, late 19th century America is directly influenced by Persian culture. Now, some of this is not necessarily a good influence, because by the late 19th century, you have the translation of Khayyam. And Khayyam, the great poet of the jug of wine and the loaf of bread, is the only version of Khayyam that they offer. In other words, the Romantics were... If I drink more, then I have another problem. Now, because I have, I think, only 5 minutes... I have to try to give you a very... I was going to talk a little bit about some of these people, some of the examples that I think in this rereading of Persian tradition can be found to help us. In the West, modernity and this new concept of freedom emerged after a rebirth of old classics. Renaissance means rebirth. What was reborn was elements of tradition that had been completely obfuscated, completely obliterated by Christianity. Renaissance thinkers went to the well of their own tradition and from it found what was useful and brought it and allowed that to become the culture of the time. And with it, they shape a new vision of the world. Our modernity, our concept of freedom, is not going to come from French literature, is not going to come from American literature, is not going to come from Marx or other literatures. It is going to come only from within our own tradition. Not an exclusive reading of our tradition, but a reading of our tradition that is helped with some of these other elements that I mentioned, this global vision that I mentioned. I'll give you one example, one and a half example, and then I'll close. Historiography, notion of history, notion of writing a history that is rational, that is law-like, that is complete, that pays attention to the life of everyday people, for example, that is not a chronicle of the lives of kings alone, that believes that you can explain culture and civilization and history by the use of a rational mind. This is said to be one of the most important elements of modernity. In other words, a scientific historiography, a scientific history, is one of the key elements of historiography. The notion, Professor Holakui talked about this the other day, the notion that there is something called the science of society, we generally think comes from the West. In 19th century, positivism came, and from positivism, other things developed, and they brought it to Iran, and people were introduced to Auguste Comte and Marx and all of these other people, Vico and everybody else, and we began to learn modern historiography. I strongly urge you to go back and read Tariqa Behaqi. Tariqa Behaqi not only is one of the most beautiful examples of Persian prose, but in it you will find elements of a historiography that in terms of its modernity, in terms of its rational attempt to explain lives, and not just life, the life of Mas'ud or Mahmud, but the life of everyday people, the terminology of everyday life, the terminology of the street, the price of things, the price of everything, almost the figure, the structure of the court, the structure of marriage, all of these things are said in a very, very systematic way. If we want to be a scientific historian, we have to begin at Beihaqi, not at Auguste Comte. So far, we have done the other. The notion of democracy, they tell us, is essentially, quintessentially Western. Professor Hakak read from Attar, read some beautiful parts of Attar, but I urge you to read Dastan-e-Simarq. Dastan, the Manteghoteir, the conference of birds, is about democracy in the best possible way. There are 30 birds who go on a pilgrimage to find that one mythical bird that will tell them everything. At the end of the road, they find that the mythical bird they had been looking for, the ultimate source of wisdom they had been looking for, is in their collectivity. They are 30 birds. This gathering is the Simarq. We don't need to learn democracy from Athens. We can begin right here at Sheraton. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Milani. Emerson, when he would see a friend, he mentioned Emerson as one of the greatest thinkers of the West. When he would see his friends, he would say, "What has come clear to you since we last met?" And I want you to think about it, that what has come clear to us since we started this conference and what has become clear to us since an hour ago. How we can think Iranian and yet global, how we can really raise the self-esteem and self-confidence of our children and our society by looking at some of the points that Dr. Abbas-e Milani mentioned, and how we look forward to reading more of his writings and to make things more clear to us as to what our heritage is and how we can take the positive and discard some of the scars that we don't want to look at. Thank you for your attention. See you in a few minutes. Bye-bye.